supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Support for Voices in the Family is made possible in part by the generous support of Devereaux, the nation's largest nonprofit provider of behavioral health care for children, adolescents, and adults with developmental and intellectual disabilities, behavioral disorders, and mental illness. Devereaux operates at 15 centers in 11 states throughout the country.
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to today's show. According to today's guest, almost everyone knows what a nerd is. There are stereotypical telltale signs, you know, the thick glasses or braces or acne, maybe even a pocket protector. Nerds are very smart and sometimes socially awkward. He says that by age six, many children know they don't know what a nerd is, but they know they don't want to be one. And why not? It appears that while most offensive stereotypes are not tolerated in mainstream society, the people we call nerds are still a safe target of ridicule and put-downs. But why is that? Well, of course, children are most hurt by this, but we as a nation are also worse off when we shame and discourage our smartest kids. After all, they're the ones we need. Well, here to talk about this is David Anderegg. He's a professor of psychology at Bennington College in Vermont, and he's the author of Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. He joins us by phone from Bennington, Vermont. David, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me, Dan.
And if you would like to join our conversation, please give us a call. We're at 888-477-9499. If you are a nerd or were a nerd, or if you're concerned about your children being called nerds, give us a call. 888-477-9499. Well, David, we've got to start with a definition. I want to know what a nerd is, and I want to know, you're interested in this. Are you a nerd? Where are you a nerd?
Well, first of all, a nerd is somebody who... a nerd is a stereotype. I sometimes like to say that there is no such thing as a nerd because we just have people who more or less fit this vilified stereotype. But I sometimes like to point to the fact that it doesn't really mean that nerds exist in any sense other than in cultural space, which is really where they exist. They exist on TV is where they exist. But the question about me being a nerd, I think that's a very interesting question because I have been asked it often enough that I've developed an answer having to do with complexity. I sometimes say, well, let's see, I really enjoy Baroque counterpoint, and also I enjoy the Boston Red Sox, and I sometimes teach research methodology and design, and I also am greatly enjoying learning to play golf. So you tell me if that makes me a nerd.
You are a Renaissance nerd.
Maybe.
A whole new label. So in my research, the concept of nerd comes up as early as a Dr. Seuss book in the 60s, where the narrator, Gerald McGrew, claims that he would collect, and this is a quote, a Nurkle, a nerd, and a seersucker, too, for his imaginary zoo. Of Dr. Seuss, of all places to begin this.
Well, actually, the word first appeared in print in Newsweek in the early 1950s, and used in its current sense of somebody who is very good at technology and also is socially awkward. Nobody really knows where it came from, but Dr. Seuss, I don't think, originated the term. I think he was just playing with words. I don't even think he was meaning to use it in that sense. But I think it was 1953 or 1954, it appeared in Newsweek for the first time.
Your book says that this concept is somehow introduced to children even by their parents. I mean, and that's kind of what I said in the introduction. I mean, kids as young as age six know they don't want to be nerds, but they don't know what nerds are.
Well, yeah, that's the intonation thing, right? Because children are very, very sensitive to intonation, and they know an insult when they hear one. So when they hear older kids, or sometimes their parents, saying, oh, you're such a nerd, they know that this is something that that's bad. The first thing kids learn about nerds is that they're bad, and everything else comes after that. But they know that because of the intonation, and so that's why I suggest sometimes that parents are instructing kids in a negative stereotype, even when they don't think they're doing that. When they use the word with that sort of derogatory, sneery kind of voice that a lot of people do, then kids try and figure out, okay, what is this? Because I want to make sure that I'm not one of those. And then they start trying to build up their idea of what exactly it is.
Hmm. I want to read you something that our producer, Emily Haas, put out a request on Facebook for people to write her about their nerd experience. I want to read you something that's from H, who's 30 years old. And this sounds similar to what you're talking about now. He says, I still have these intense periods of learning. My parents nicknamed them educational emergencies when I was a kid, where I'll get completely obsessed with learning a new thing. Let's just say that the fable of the ugly duckling tends to resonate pretty strongly for nerds when they're children. Once we grow up and become fully fledged, we find out our team of nerd supporters, and then we take over the world. So much of our world is run or directed by nerds. It's unreal.
Well, I think it's wonderful. It's very sweet to hear the ugly duckling metaphor. And it's absolutely true that when young people who have been labeled as nerds, when they grow up and find other people who share their passion for their interests, they usually feel a whole lot better. I am concerned about the kids who do the labeling than I am in the long run about the people who are labeled as nerds. Because the people who are doing the labeling are the kids who are in more trouble.
How so?
Well, first of all, we live in an environment where science and technology are absolutely vital in order to get a job. The area where I live has been losing jobs for years, and now there's going to be a whole influx of jobs, and they're all for software developers and people with low-level engineering skills and all sorts of science and technology applications. And that's really where the future of employment is. And my concern is that kids in middle school who decide they don't want to be labeled as nerds, and since being interested in science and technology and computers is such an integral part of the stereotype, that kids decide, I'm not that kind of person. I don't want to do that. That's not for me. And then years later, after they outgrow the stereotype, it's kind of too late to go back and take all those science and math classes that they missed. And so I'm really concerned about that in terms of our future and in terms about the effects of this negative stereotype on our children.
Apropos of that, a dear friend of mine in middle school was getting great grades, and, you know, some people started calling her nerds, and she said she got C's and D's for the rest of her academic career, and that's kind of heartbreaking. I mean, she's a bright woman. I would call her brilliant, and it's just heartbreaking. My hunch is she's not the only one that did that.
Well, yeah, part of my interest in the first place in this was because I am, in addition to being teaching psychology in a college, I'm also a clinical psychologist with an active child psychotherapy practice. Mm. And I've heard over and over again that story when kids are brought by their families because all of a sudden they're not doing well in school. And one of the reasons they're not doing well in school is because they've become aware of these stereotypes and they start sabotaging themselves. And I think that's a pretty bad idea myself.
Yeah, that's really heartbreaking. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about nerds and those who stereotype nerds and what it means for both sides. My guest is David Anderegg, and he's written a book on that topic. Give us a call at 888-477-9499 if you were a nerd, if you still consider yourself a nerd, or if your children are. Give us a call if you're worried about your children becoming nerds also. That's 888-477-9499. David, we've got a lot of people who want to join the conversation. Let's go right to Steve. Hi, Steve. You're on the... Hi, Steve.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because my wife is a nerd. I am not, and I love being married to a nerd, and I think nerds win.
Why do you call your wife a nerd?
Actually, she would call herself that.
Do you know?
She went. You know, she's very, very smart. Achieved a lot academically, and is. But mostly, what I have seen, and you talk about kids fearing the term, is that oftentimes nerd is equated with kids who are good kids, kids who follow the rules. You know.
Hmm. Yeah,
and that's scary to me. That my own kids, I think, struggle with that because they're kind of like their mother, and I think it's amazingly wonderful. But oftentimes they'll be called a nerd because they don't want to do the bad thing. They want to be obedient, or they want to be nice, and kids will call them nerds because of that.
Well, so let me turn to you, David. What's a parent to do? What can a parent do to ease the potential pain a child like this is going to face?
Well, it's very difficult to ease that pain in the moment, but I'm so glad Steve brought this up, because one of the things I like to talk about is the fact that the word stereotype nerd also, when used by kids, implies some kind of correct relationship between kids and adults, right? It means the kids who are not too influenced by adults. And they are sometimes vilified by other kids. I do think sometimes that's because of envy, because I think kids who are close to their parents and somewhat protected and have a family life where they do a lot of stuff together and like to keep their parents happy are actually pretty happy kids. And sometimes I think the label is applied out of envy, because kids who are kind of adrift and extremely self-conscious and trying to figure out how to make it in the world without adult guidance get kind of mad about that situation. But what to do about it? What to do about it, of course, the most important thing to do is to find peers for your kids. And if that means finding peers outside of school, that's what it means. I'm a big advocate of summer camp for that reason, and after-school activities where kids, if they are picked on by their peers, they can find other kids who share their values, which can be a great antidote to that kind of teasing at school. But I also think it's very, very important for parents not to give up and not to and to understand that parental influence in the long run is a very positive, very good thing for kids. It's what all kids need, and you know, and not to be discouraged by this name calling in the short term.
Steve, I guess we lost Steve. One thing I would also want to add for parents, David, is that one of the things that happens with these kids is they feel very much alone in the world, and you implied that by, you know, encouraging them to find kids with similar values. But I would encourage parents not to act on their impulse to minimize kids' suffering and to tell them it's not that bad, or, you know, that it, what's happening, it's really not happening. And I think the best thing you could do for your kid who's suffering discrimination is just to sit down and listen to them, listen to their sense of being alone, and listen to maybe their anger, and help them with their confusion, as difficult as that might be.
I think that's absolutely right. I don't think kids' suffering should ever be minimized.
I want to talk about the human experience of being a nerd and facing discrimination throughout one's childhood and maybe beyond. What are the internal experiences of these children? How do they feel about themselves? I know that's a sweeping generalization, but could you at least talk to the question?
Well, the kids I've talked to in this situation are oftentimes surprised and confused because all of a sudden they're going along, first of all, having a good time and learning things and having an enthusiasm for learning and being close to their parents and sometimes being a little, some nerd-labeled kids can be a little oblivious to the social concerns of the people around them, like, you know, what's the most important thing to wear and all that. But very frequently when kids first get this label, they're very surprised because they've been going along having a great time and all of a sudden something is happening which makes it seem like they are very negative. And it's who they are is a very negative thing to be. And so very frequently when it first happens, I've talked with kids who are just like shocked. Most of them are like, you know, what's wrong with me? I'm fine. I feel fine. Why is everybody treating me as if there's something wrong with me? And after that, then some kids can sort of hang on and decide that they are who they are and their interests are what they are and they're going to be true to themselves. And other kids just decide they're going to go for protective camouflage.
Well, I'm curious about something, though. We know with racial and ethnic discrimination that these kids tend to absorb what's going on outside of them and begin to feel as though they are what they're hearing. Does that happen with nerds?
Oh, I think so, because I talk to groups of teachers about this, and I'm always trying to get teachers to notice that, science and math teachers, if they have internalized these stereotypes in weird ways, I keep telling science and math teachers to stop apologizing for complexity. When you see a teacher saying, stick with me here. Now, I know this is kind of nerdy, but I want you to pay attention anyway. That kind of, apologizing for your interests and your expertise and apologizing because you're enthusiastic about something, especially if it's science and math. I don't think people have anything to apologize for.
Listen, we've got to take a short break, and I want to tell you that when we come back from our break, I spoke with Emily Haas, our intern, a self-proclaimed nerd, about the experience of being a nerd, and we'll hear that when we come back from our break. I also want to mention to you, David, that, I spoke with Jennifer Lynn, our producer, right before the show, and I said, do you think we're going to get a lot of calls or no calls? Because I really had no sense of this. And I just want to tell you that all the lines are filled, so there's a lot of people that are really resonating to the subject matter. Well, like I said, we've got a short break. We'll be back in 60 seconds. We'll hear from Emily, and we'll go right to the phone lines. We're talking with David Anderegg. He's a professor of psychology at Bennington College in Vermont. He's written Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on 91 FM.
Supporting WHYY, Beaumont at Bryn Mawr is a gracious resident-owned continuing care retirement community in the heart of the Main Line. Beaumont invites you to an exclusive hands-on presentation by the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society on Saturday, April 30th. Container gardens for small spaces, followed by a special lunch in the Austin Mansion with our executive chef. To reserve a seat, RSVP at 610-526-7000. Event information at BeaumontRetirement.com. The number again, 610-526-7000.
Are we alone in the universe? It's an age-old question. On the next Fresh Air, astrobiologist Mark Kaufman says we may be closer than ever to finding out if life exists on other planets. His new book is First Contact, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about nerds with David Anderegg. He's a professor of psychology at Bennington College, and he's written Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. Well, like I said, before the show, I recorded a conversation with our ace intern and my dear friend, Emily Haas. She's a self-described nerd. Here's what we talked about. You know, you described yourself as a nerd to me, and I was shocked, and frankly, I didn't believe you. I thought you were kidding.
I was both pleased and displeased by that.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, say why you were pleased and why you were displeased.
I was pleased in a sense because it means that I've assimilated well enough that people don't necessarily look at me and think, oh, that's a nerd, we're going to shun her, which is clearly an experience that I've had, even though it's not necessarily an experience I have all the time. It means that I can socialize now in general. I've learned how to do that. So I'm pleased that you don't automatically look at me and stereotype me. I think anybody who has ever been stereotyped would be pleased by that. But I'm displeased only in that you then assumed that being a nerd is a negative thing and that I would not want to be considered a nerd. I don't think there should be any shame in it. That's really my main point in this whole conversation.
Tell me what a nerd is.
To me, the main part of being a nerd is not ever wanting to be apathetic about topics you're interested in. There's a certain aspect of being cool, especially in social situations, that requires that you distance yourself from your own interests, and especially if they are intellectual or academic interests. So being a nerd is really getting intensely enthusiastic about things, even if other people don't necessarily think they are cool. So it's not exactly the same as being intelligent. It's really much more about the intense way in which you engage with your subjects of interest.
Well, wait a minute. I've got intense interest in the Phillies, in the human mind, how people work.
I think it's very similar. If you're somebody who knows all of the Philly statistics, that is something that a nerd would do. I think that because of our cultural understanding of nerds, we don't think of sports people as nerds in this way. But really, it is about understanding the obscure details.
So as a clinician, I would sounds like you're describing almost an obsessive interest.
Is really almost what it is. It borders on obsession, but it's not negative. I think it can be conceived as negative.
Do you have a lot of anxiety?
I don't anymore. About being a nerd, do you mean?
No, in general.
No, I don't have a lot of anxiety. I have a lot of interest. I have a lot of passion about things.
What was it like growing up as a nerd?
I felt that there were very few people who had the same kinds of interests that I did, and even fewer who would let me feel comfortable expressing my own interests in those things.
You felt isolated?
I did, absolutely. And it had a lot to do with my growing up in a very small town. I think it's easier if you have more people to associate with.
Did you feel lonely?
I did. I frequently did. I always had friends, and I was never mercilessly ridiculed. But I very frequently felt apart from the world, and few people did much to help that.
Did you feel ashamed being a nerd?
I think I did. I think I had enough sense of self to know that it wasn't my fault and that it wasn't actually a bad thing. But I frequently felt some shame.
What makes life easier for nerds? What made life easier for you? You said you felt alone and ashamed. What helped?
Truly, I don't think anything helped until I got to college and found other people like me. Your advice of finding kindred spirits is really the best I've ever heard. You need to find people who are similar to you and who will accept you, and then you can begin to accept yourself as a nerd.
So you argue that you are a nerd, and then I see your interests. You know, we are Facebook friends. So I see your interests, and my first reaction is, okay, now I get it. You know, there's No way I would be interested in stuff like that. But
I can name some of them. I'd be amused.
I still don't. I wouldn't use that label for you. You know, just that your interests are way different from mine. And maybe if we were friends on the outside, not just Facebook friends, and hung out, we would struggle with finding common interests. But I'm sure we would. So I don't see that as a nerd, just someone with different interests.
That's why I'm so careful in how I define the word nerd. To me, and I think that the other people I speak with who would also consider themselves nerds would agree with me that it really isn't about what the interest is. It doesn't have to be Star Trek, and it doesn't have to be Latin grammar. It's about the way you want to understand that subject, whatever it is. If you get joy in that perfect grasp of a potentially very arcane subject, then you're a nerd, to me.
Not me.
No, you're not a nerd, but I love you anyway, Dan.
And I love you, too. You are my my favorite nerd.
Oh, I appreciate it.
That was our ace intern, Emily Haas, who's also my favorite nerd. If you're just tuning in, we're talking with David Anderegg about nerds. He's written Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. David, there was a lot there in that interview.
I'll say. I absolutely agree with Emily's definition. One of the things that I point to in my book is that one of the ways that kids learn about the content of this stereotype is by looking at self-tests on the internet. And one of the most appalling items I found, I think actually it might have been on a Are You a Geek self-test, not an Are You a Nerd self-test, but they're frequently interchangeable. The question was, when you go to a movie with friends, do you find that after the movie you want to talk about the movie with your friends? And if the answer is yes, your score goes way up, which I find absolutely unbelievable.
Yeah.
That even that amount of enthusiasm, that you're supposed to go to a movie, but if you show enthusiasm for talking about it, then that means that somehow you participate in this uncool social category.
Give me a break.
Pardon?
Give me a break.
I know, that's exactly my feeling. Give me a break.
Listen, I want to talk about something, and I could embarrass myself here a bit, but one of the reasons I was shocked when Emily called me a nerd is because she is a, she might be offended by this word, she is an adorable young woman. She's very pretty. And, you know, that just threw my orientation off about, you know, I grow up in that world. So, you know, it threw my orientation off about how can someone who's pretty be a nerd. And I talked to her about it. And she said that her attractiveness wasn't even a factor as she was being seen as a nerd. She said, nerds are almost seen as a third gender. They're not attractive. They're asexual. You agree?
Well, I certainly think that the stereotype includes being unattractive. I mean, it's more confusing for women because it's largely a male stereotype. And by that, I mean if you ask people to just describe a stereotypical nerd, 99% of people will describe a man. But it certainly is true that the content of the stereotype on the self-test or, you know, the show on TV, one of my least favorite TV shows ever, Beauty and the Geek, which had all these young men who were extremely accomplished in science and math and engineering and things like that, and they were selected to be unappealing, unattractive, awkward. The last season of Beauty and the Geek, they actually showed about, I think it was almost 60 seconds of one of them picking his nose on national TV. And so there's a tremendous amount of cultural indoctrination that teaches us that people who fit this stereotype are very unappealing. And it's absolutely not true. I sometimes tell people if they want to believe me, that you go take a walk around the campus of MIT or Harvard or any place where nerds are supposed to congregate. There's a lot of very attractive young people walking around there. It's not like some sort of, you know, freak museum. The stereotype is it's false. It's
right.
Plainly false.
Right. Well, our lines are lit up. There's a lot of people who want to join the conversation. So let's go right to the lines. We've got Jerry on the line. Hi, Jerry.
Hello, Dr. Stan. Wanted to bring up a point. Speaking of MIT, that's where I went to school. But I think there's an expectation for nerds to be the smartest ones all the time, and that creates an unrealistic expectation on them and a lot of stress on them also. I wonder if there's any comments on that.
David?
Yes. Certainly this happens to any kid in school who's a smart kid. It certainly happened to me when I was in school, that if I got one wrong answer on a test, or if I raised my hand and answered a question and it was wrong, I was mocked by all my classmates because, you know, I thought you knew everything, you know, that sort of thing. And so it certainly amps up the pressure in a social situation on intelligent kids, even kids who aren't nerd-labeled kids. I think we have such ambivalence as a culture. We have such ambivalence about intellectual excellence. We know we need it. We know we need it in order to compete, and we know we need it to survive, except people are so hostile when they actually encounter it.
Jerry?
Yeah, one other comment. While at MIT, there was a kid that actually committed suicide because he got a B on an exam.
Well, I would say, Jerry, that he didn't commit suicide because he got a B on the exam. Or everything we know about suicide says that he committed suicide because he was depressed. And the B might have been the trigger, but there had been something building up for years. Jerry, thanks so much for your call. We are trying very hard to put a human face on these labels, and I appreciate it. Let's continue with the phones, David, because we do have a lot of people.
Okay.
Let's go right to David. Hey, David.
Hi,
David.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a proud self-proclaimed nerd. I'm proactively raising two daughters and eventually a son, a six-year-old and an eight-year-old daughter who are proud self-proclaimed nerds. And I just want to make the point that from the discussion, except what your intern contributed, there's this kind of focus on nerds as science and techie people. I'm a humanities nerd. I teach Sanskrit at a university. So I think it's important to recognize nerd as a good thing, as a valuable thing. And in particular, we live in a culture now where the humanities are less and less valued, and so I think it's important to have a positive idea of humanities nerds as well.
That's a good point. And you know, David, Emily talked about, you know, the issue as she grew with this, grew psychologically with this. Now there's no more shame associated with it. She is who she is, and that's really the issue. That's really what growth is about for all of us, is being comfortable inside our skin with who we are.
Yeah, well, you know, it's one of the things I think that works against us being as alarmed as I think we should be. I think it's great that people eventually get to feel comfortable in their own skin, including me. But sometimes when we look back on this and we outgrow this label and we think it's childish foolishness, which it is, I think we then tend to forget that people make decisions based on that childish foolishness. I was talking to someone the other day who was at NSF, the National Science Foundation, and she was involved in trying to get more kids interested in computer programming as a career. And she noted that despite the fact that there are all these jobs available in the world of computing, the number of people, of American students, who are pursuing computer programming as a major in college has dropped precipitously during the decade from 2000 to 2010.
Wow.
And so the question is, you know, what's that all about? Mm-hmm. And I think what it's about is that these stereotypes are very powerful when you're a kid, and then after you realize you are comfortable in your skin and you're comfortable with being who you are and all that, but for all those kids who shot themselves in the foot when they were in middle school or high school, it's very difficult to go back and reinvent yourself. Very difficult to go back and take 4 years of pre-calculus math when you're in college. Wow. And so I do think that a lot of people become more comfortable and feel fine about and embrace a nerd stereotype in a very positive way, and I think that's great. But I also think it's important to remember that it has a real effect on real people's lives in middle school.
We've got to take a break in just a couple of minutes, but one of our callers, Michael, wanted to know about the roots of this anti-intellectualism. Where did it come from?
Well, as a nation, some of it comes from the fact that we were trying to establish ourselves as an intellectual culture separate from the intellectual culture of Europe. And Europe, when we started out as a nation, European intellectuals, it was all about book learning and libraries and universities. And we actively invented this idea of the American intellectual, or as Ralph Waldo Emerson wrote, the American scholar, someone who learns from nature, someone who is practical, someone who is manly, someone who is not all that interested in books except when you have to be interested in books. So I think there's an old bifurcation that goes way back to the beginning of our country between a suspicion about book learning and intellectual achievement on the one hand, and on the other hand, practical, active, natural, that kind of intellectual. That's the American way.
We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to take some more calls. But I also want to talk to you about nerds and Asperger's syndrome because, you know, when I read your book, it got me thinking about it, and I'm sure a lot of people are thinking about it. So we'll talk about nerds and Asperger's. Before we go to break, I want to read another Facebook quote. This is from D, another male who's aged also 30. I definitely felt ostracized as a little kid for doing well in school and not being into sports. People would pick on how I phrase things, he says, and they still do. He goes on to say in sixth grade, classes were untracked, and I got very bored and felt very isolated because the students seemed to resent me. I was about 42 times I was absent from school because of this, and I wore black all the time. He says he got so many answers right so much of the time that my teachers began to ask me not to answer questions during class. Just one experience of someone who felt like a nerd, was treated like a nerd in school. Well, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about nerds and what it means. We're talking with David Anderick, who's a professor of psychology at Bennington College in Vermont. He's written Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Abington Health supports WHYY and announces the opening of its new Orthopedic and Spine Institute, located at both Abington Memorial Hospital and Lansdale Hospital. Offering minimally invasive procedures for joint and spine performed by board-certified surgeons. To access their online pain assessment and to learn if a specialist could help, abingtonhealth.org/bone or 215-481-BONE. That's abingtonhealth.org/bone or 215-481-BONE.
This month, the folks at O Magazine are rolling out their poetry issue in honor of National Poetry Month. The magazine takes a look at the innovators of the spoken word. We get a special peek into the pages of O Magazine from its editor-in-chief, Susan Casey. That's next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We We are talking about nerds here on Voices in the Family with David Anderegg, who's written Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. Before our break, I read a Facebook entry by Dee, who talked about how difficult it was. And, you know, his last sentence was, "My teachers began to ask me not to answer questions during class." We've got Diane here who wants to join us, but she wants to address the issues of schools also. So let's talk with Diane, and then we'll talk about schools, what schools are doing. Diane?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've noticed with a middle schooler and a soon-to-middle schooler that even in academically challenging schools or schools that present themselves as academically challenging, sports are where honors are given in very public ways with, you know, an entire auditorium or gym full of kids screaming and stamping their feet. There's nothing similar for the kid who has done the best on a science project or made the best presentation. Those honors are mostly confined to the people who saw the presentation or maybe reflected in a student's grades, which is wonderful, but there is a big difference between having anywhere from a few hundred to 1,000 kids screaming your name and getting something in the mail. And I know that for some schools it's a matter of budget, but I also wonder if what we can do as parents to encourage the honoring of non-sports achievements.
David?
Well, it's very, very difficult because, once again, we're pushing against a cultural tide. You may have seen in the State of the Union address, President Obama suggested that we need to celebrate the winner of the high school science fair as much as we celebrate the winner of the Super Bowl. And so, obviously, it's something which we need to pay attention to. I do think that parent advocacy is very, very important, and I think that that's one of the reasons, or that's one of the ways things change, is that parents can advocate for their children and call attention to these kinds of inequities. I don't think we're going to see right away, we're going to see pep rallies where people are celebrating winner of the science fair, but I think we can point out systematic prejudice in our schools. I mean, it's kind of problematic because it is circular. The reason that we have these pep rallies for athletics is because they are more highly valued, because people are somewhat suspicious of intellectual achievement. So it's hard to know where to break into the cycle, but parent advocacy is definitely one place to break in and to say, look, you need to do more. You need to follow the president's example, and we need to figure out some kind of public celebration for our most interesting or technically advanced or accomplished students.
And I think the president was right. I mean, he implied this is a larger cultural issue. I was in Taiwan a couple of years ago, David and Diane, and it was really just the opposite. They literally had pep rallies for intellectual achievement. I was over there as an author, and I was in a Catholic high school, and I mean, they were in the rafters. They were, you know, they were throwing confetti. They were so thrilled to have an author in there. And it's a whole different culture. I couldn't see that happening in a high school in America, no matter which high school.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to picture, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Diane, thanks so much for your call. Let's take another call from Will. Hey, Will, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. I just wanted to embarrass myself and blurt out that we nerds find smart sexy. Basically that, you know, especially for those of us who have trouble expressing ourselves succinctly because our mouths get ahead of our brains, which are running around in circles, you know, we, those of us who are sort of in the nerd community, find the ability to be, you know, brilliant and also yet articulate and, you know, to come up with, you know, sort of brilliant distillations of concepts like, your intern did earlier to be just absolutely amazing. And so I think that's, I think part of a bad thing tying into the theme of the show today is that that seems to be something that is only valued within the nerd community a lot, and, you know, is, you know, like, as you say, you know, you wouldn't have a pep rally for a science fair winner here, and, you know, I can definitely look on that with disappointment in my past, but, you know, and, but it's, I just wish, I just wish other people would, you know, celebrate the luminary among us like we celebrate them.
Right. And let me just suggest, Will, you said you were going to embarrass yourself. I just want to tell you, I don't, you didn't embarrass yourself, but I want to ask you a question that might embarrass you. Okay, so don't give up hope about the embarrassment thing. you there?
Oh, yes, I'm still here.
All right. So you said you find smart sexy. Do you mean that literally?
Yes, absolutely literally, especially coming up with, you know, interesting and insightful ways of, you know, looking at a concept, elegant solution to some sort of problem, any of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting to me. David, do you have a reaction? And thanks for calling in, Will. You still didn't embarrass yourself, but thanks for calling
in. Well, yeah, I have lots of thoughts about that. The cultural trend, of course, is in the other direction, and we are constantly bombarded by images which teach us that one can be smart or sexy, but not both, right? That you have to choose. And we know that's not true. And we know that people who are intelligent find other intelligent people appealing in all kinds of ways, including being sexy. And so the problem is, how are we going to get that message out, so to speak, or to counter the other message, which is so prevalent in the culture? I think one of the things we can do is we can, certainly with children, we can do some media education where we talk to our kids about what is on TV and don't let them watch it, or if they do watch it, to deconstruct it for them so they understand that what they're seeing is a stereotype. Yeah. There's a very popular show on TV right now, The Big Bang Theory, which teaches us that scientists are, they're awkward and dopey, and they're not conventionally sexy, and once in a while they get a girlfriend, and they're kind of cute, they're kind of like mascots, you know. Yeah. They're not scary anymore, they're like our awkward, dopey mascots.
And I think
that's ridiculous.
They need to know that those mascots invented Microsoft and put people on the moon.
Exactly.
I said before our break a while ago that I wanted to talk about Asperger's. So you see this as a way to pathologize nerdiness when we look at the overlap between the two.
Well, yeah, I believe in that there is such a thing as normal variation. And I think your intern put this perfectly. Enthusiasm for a subject is a good thing. And enthusiasm for a subject, of course, not everybody is equally interested in everything. So enthusiasm for one particular subject falls within the realm of normal variation. But now there's so much attention on autistic spectrum disorders that people who are sometimes labeled with the nerd stereotype are also described as a little Aspergy, or they're like on the spectrum, as if there's not only do they participate in a devalued social stereotype, but they're also sick. And I don't think there's anything sick about enthusiasm. I really don't. It is true that one of the diagnostic criteria of Asperger's syndrome is that you're so enthusiastic that you don't know when to stop. But that's different from regular old normal enthusiasm. And I don't think it does anybody a service to overextend a diagnosis of illness in situations where there's absolutely no illness present. And it's not clear thinking, and it doesn't really do anybody any good.
I'm inclined to agree, but, there is overlap. I would imagine some of the people in this label of nerds do not know when to stop with their enthusiastic pursuit of whatever they're pursuing. And, you know, they might be so involved in this and also have pretty poor social skills. And that's an overlap with someone on the spectrum.
Yeah, that, I mean, you know, if you go to the extreme, which sometimes I do about this, one can think about the overvaluation of social skills. I really don't think everybody in the world needs to have the social skills of a salesman, and I don't have anything against salesmen, but, you know, they have the eye contact and the affability and all of that stuff that somebody in sales is supposed to have. I don't think we all have to have that.
Well, that gets back to a point I made, you know, a while ago in our conversation about the real issue is being comfortable with who you are.
Yes.
Comfortable inside your skin, whether you have, you know, a label nerd or Asperger's or depression or bipolar. You know, the issue is for quality of life is to be comfortable with who you are. So we're going to have to end there. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I've really enjoyed our conversation, David. Thank you.
It's a lot of fun to talk to another psychologist.
Yeah, it is. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
David Anderegg is a professor of psychology at Bennington College in Vermont. He's the author of Nerds, How Dorks, Dweebs, Techies, and Trekkies Can Save America. My apologies to our many, many callers who didn't get on the line, on the air. Next week on Voices in the Family, we're going to be talking about creating your ideal family size. Well, if you've got a question, show idea, or comment, you can email us at voices@whyy.org. And if you want to reach me, I'm at drdangottlieb.com. And, of course, archived editions of our shows are on whyy.org/voices. Well, the engineer for our show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is the executive producer of audio content at WHYY. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. And by now, you all know who our intern is. She is my favorite nerd, Emily Haas. Thanks so much, Emily, for your contribution to this show. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Enjoy your week, my friends.